Okay, so that was a bit of experimenting with a little bit of death contemplation. So I hope that had, if it didn't work, then that's, it's always uncertain with these things. So we try these things out and see what happens. But the process is obviously fairly well known, so you can try these things on your own if you want, if it was a positive experience for you. Okay, let's go over to the questions tonight. So first of all, there's a announcement here about retreat CDs. So this is a sign we're coming to the end of the retreat. Oh no, so fast. Okay, it says here that for the participants resident in WA, retreat CDs will be available at the BSWA library. Our former BSWA treasurer, Pauline, who is here on the retreat, she has generously made a generous gesture to post retreat CDs to all interstate and all overseas retreat participants. Excellent. Well done, Pauline. That's very nice, very kind of you. Cost of production and postage will be paid by her. These participants are requested to leave their postal address and email ad on a sheet of paper in the dining hall soon. So if you leave it there, then she can send it out. We also should say thank you to Miss Isurika, who prepares the audio files for CD production. Okay, excellent. Well then, so I hope that is clear, and so that everybody can get the CD. If you want one, that is it. Then you have it available. Okay, so let's have a look at tonight's questions. Dear Ajahn, can you kindly explain again how to practice the four foundations of mindfulness? Thank you. Okay, I can do that, but it will have to be fairly brief, obviously, because these things are quite involved. But as I was saying, the main importance of these four foundations of mindfulness, as I understand them, is that they are there to overcome the defilements of the mind, overcome attachments that we have to the body. So the first foundation of mindfulness is all about the body, essentially. It's a body contemplation. And the most important one of those body contemplations is the one about 31 parts of the body. So you kind of review the body having 31 parts. And the idea with that is that you lose some of your attachment to the body in that process. So this is what it's about, right? And then it's about understanding in the mind the difference between feelings that have to do with attachment, that have to do with defilements, and those feelings that have to do with purity of mind, the mind states that are pure, the mind states that are defiled. And in the last Satipatthana, the Dhammanupassana, it's all about reviewing, looking inside of yourself. You know, you do the meditation practice, and as you do it, you are also aware. You can't really avoid that. You also have awareness of what is happening, what are the problems that is going on. And you know that afterwards when you come out. And once you get an insight into your problems, then you can do something about it, right? You see that, for example, you see that you're getting upset with somebody. This happens. So a little bit of ill will arises. Okay, so you think, okay, how can I deal with this? How can I look at this person differently so this doesn't arise for me in the future? Your meditation only goes to a certain depth. Why is that? Probably because you are attached to the senses or attached to the body in one way or another. How can I avoid that? We are going to look more tomorrow, I think it is, about how to deal with attachment to sensuality, sense pleasures, and also to all the objects of the sensual world. I will talk a little bit about that in very general terms, and hopefully that will also give you some ideas. So it's all about knowing what's happening inside of you, right? How is your mind working? Why doesn't it go any further? Understanding the blockages. These are called the nivaranas in Pali. What translated the hindrances. These really are the hindrances that stop you from making progress in meditation. And this is what Satipatthana is all about. The foundations of mindfulness, or the focuses of mindfulness, which I would prefer as a translation. That is what they are about. And they bring you to samadhi, right? This is the purpose of Satipatthana, is to take you to samadhi eventually. So you have like insights, small insights into yourself. that take you to samadhi. And after samadhi, that's when you're ready for the big insights into the nature of existence. As I read that the first day, samadhi pachaya yata bhuta jnanadasana. Samadhi is the condition for seeing things in accordance with reality. You cannot see things according to reality without samadhi. That is straight from the suttas. Okay. Dear Ajahn, the suttas we discussed this evening about developing compassion. What was the other sutta similar in message? Vitakka sutta. Yeah, Vitakka Santana sutta. Vitakka Santana. Santana is calming. Vitakka is thought. So this is the discourse on the calming of thought. Majjhima Nikaya number 20. 2-0. Majjhima Nikaya 2-0. It's a nice sutta. And there's also the one before that, which also is very nice, Majjhima Nikaya 19, the Dveda Vitakka Sutta, two kinds of thoughts, is that sutta. They're both very nice, all about how to deal with the thinking mind. Okay. And by the way, those suttas, I did do them last year, I think, on this retreat last year. So they have been done here as well, because they're very, very useful. Dear Ajahn, when the rebirth occurs, do we, Gandhaba, I think the word is you're trying to say there, decide which parents we want, which country, which gender, etc.? Or does the karma decide? Could you please explain about the simile of the stick with metta? Little flowers have been drawn, that's very nice. So, okay. The Gandhaba is the word, Gandhaba. But anyway, that's good enough. I understand what you're saying here. Do we decide? Well, in a sense you decide, but in a sense you don't. We tend to go according to our mental states, right? Our attachments, our desires. So if you have attachments to certain people, your mind sort of inclines in that direction. And it's quite possible, quite likely, that you will be reborn with people that you already know quite well, right? In a family that is already close to you or whatever. Perhaps your current family, but perhaps the relationships will be reversed, right? It's always interesting. In this life, you're the child. The next life, you might be the parent. It's kind of weird to think of yourself as your parent of your own parents, for example. So things turned upside down. And this just shows us the multiple kind of relationships that we have been in with other people throughout this long voyage or long traveling in samsara. And it means that we can have compassion and kindness for everybody, as it says in the suttas, as if they are our own children, because everybody has been our own children probably at some stage. Or you think of people as being your own mother or something like that, or your father or whatever it is. Because of all these relationships, we can always have compassion for people in that sense. So do you decide, well, the country, for example, the gender, well, again, we tend to be attached to these things, right? I come from a certain culture, so because of that, I'm attached to that culture, we're attached to that country, we're attached to this gender. We tend to attach to all of these things because they're part of our identity of who we are. And this is these things you kind of release. The more deeper you go in meditation, the more you release this kind of identity, and you just become a being, pure being. This is what the Brahmas are, they're very high beings, they're kind of pure beings of friendliness, of love, of compassion, of kindness, right? That's all they are. That's all they consist of. And they live in this very high realms. And of course, if you're going to have that purity of metta, of kindness to other beings, you can't really discriminate anymore between gender, between age, between country, between cultures. Everybody is the object of your kindness and generosity and love and these things. There is no discrimination anymore. And that's why you have to go beyond these things as you go deeper into your meditation. So we tend to be attached, right? So in that sense, we are choosing. So if you look at your attachments in this life, you will probably have some idea where you are heading in the future. So you could say it's karma. In a sense, it's karma deciding. Karma plus habits, right? Karma and habits together kind of drive you into the future. Your mind is kind of aiming for those things. Okay, simile of the stick. This is a simile found in a couple of places in the suttas where the Buddha takes up a stick in his hand and he says, if you throw up the stick and when it lands, it could land on either end, right? In the same way, when you die, you don't know where you're going to go, what kind of rebirth you're going to have. And the idea with this simile is not that your rebirth is completely random and that you can kind of be reborn anywhere, regardless. What it means is that in the long run, and in the long run we mean a really long run, right? Like in samsaric, in kind of terms of eons, sometimes you're reborn here, sometimes you're reborn there. And in the long run, it looks like this random sequence of events, random sequence of rebirths. Even if you have 1,000 rebirths in a heavenly realm, in the long run, it still looks like this random up and down yo-yo kind of thing here. So this is what it really means, that in the long run, it looks like somebody's throwing up a stick and you're reborn here, reborn there, going around. And that is problematic, right? Even if you have 1,000 heavenly rebirths or 1,000 rebirths as a human, right? Reborn here in Australia with the BSWA, with the John McGraw Retreat Center for 1,000 lifetimes. You probably get pretty fed up with this retreat center after a while, but even if that is the case eventually, even if everything is good, eventually you will have to pass away. You get reborn in somewhere less fortunate, less pleasant, less nice. That then it is problematic, right? Then that future becomes now, and it's problematic. So the only way really is to get out. But it doesn't, that simile shouldn't be taken too far, and it does not mean that your rebirths are random. It means that there is a certain risk when you die, of course. I mean, you're never 100% sure what's going to happen, but if you have lived a good life and done the right thing, the chances of getting a good rebirth, I think, are very, very high. I don't think there's much risk there if you lived a good life. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much and many merits for giving us these great teachings. I now understand the depth of Ajahn Brahm's teachings. One Friday night when someone asked how to practice kindness, he told that person to hang out with people coming to Nolamara and they will brainwash you. That's right. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that he would normally say, exactly. It's funny, people laugh, and sometimes they don't think about it enough. They don't think about that actually it is a very profound teaching. It's all about non-self, all about conditionality, and actually there's a lot of profundity in that. But sometimes Ajahn Brahm, he kind of understates his case so much that people sometimes go away thinking there wasn't any real deep message there, but actually the message is actually very deep. So yeah, thank you for saying that. And remember that when you listen to Ajahn Brahm, that some of his stories, some of his things, they often carry a lot of depth to it, even though it may seem very light and very funny at times. Anyway, so here we go. I have heard Ajahn Brahm say that Bodhinyana, John McGraw, are protected by celestial beings and spirits. Many other meditation masters also speak about devas. But I have read scholars such as Gombrich who suggest these are cultural trappings in the suttas. In his book, What the Buddha Taught, your thoughts. Richard Gombrich is a very good scholar, but he's a scholar, right? He is the ex-professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University, so one of the most kind of prestigious shares of scholarship within a kind of Indian studies or Buddhist studies as well. He also has written a lot about Buddhism as well, so very prestigious in many ways. But he's a scholar. He's not really a Buddhist. He reads these things with the eye of a scholar. And when he sees devas, he's not going to believe in devas, right? I mean, that's just not. He doesn't even believe in rebirth. I have spoken with him directly. With Ajahn Sujato a few years ago, we did this series of talks at Nolamara, the Kalman Rebirth course, and we actually had a conversation with him over Skype, and we recorded his interview and everything, and we asked him about these things, and no, he kind of dismissed this kind of whole idea of rebirth as, he didn't believe in that at all, basically. And that is a shame. That is a big shortcoming in a scholar like that. But he is obviously trapped as well, right? Trapped in the scholarly circles. As an academic, if you say that you believe in rebirth, people might laugh at you. What kind of academic are you? This is just religious stuff, right? No academic can believe in this, which of course is completely not true at all. If there is rebirth, there is rebirth. And then it doesn't matter. It's not religious anymore. It's just part of reality, part of the way the world works. Not everything is kind of yet discovered by science, so sometimes these things take time. Anyway, so that is basically the problem. So don't, when it comes to meditation practice, when it comes to some of these deeper things of reality, I don't think people like Richard Gombrich are the right people to ask. Richard Gombrich is a good person to ask if you want to ask more like scholarly questions. What is the interrelationship between the Vedas, the early scriptures in India, compared to the Buddhist scriptures? Because there is some relationship there, right? How was there a development in thought, in intellectual thought in those days? That kind of thing, he's great for her. Or if you want to learn about Sanskrit and that sort of thing, he's excellent. He does a Pali course at Oxford University every year. So if anyone of you is interested in having a super fast Pali course that goes over 3 weeks, that can be done at his little summer school that he does every year at Oxford University. So with that sort of thing, he's great. But when it comes to the kind of he doesn't know anything about meditation practice, right? He has no experience of these things. Whereas Ajahn Brahm, quite literally, is like a meditation master. His depth of meditation is very, very profound. So you're far better off asking Ajahn Brahm about those things than Richard Gombrich. Everybody has their area of expertise, and you need to kind of be careful with that. Okay. Is teddy bear meditation mentioned anywhere in the suttas? I highly recommend it for anyone who's feeling tense and lacking in metta. Actually, they're all sitting over there, right? So you are welcome to grab the teddy bears if you wish and kind of sit with the teddy bear in your lap or on your shoulders or whatever. And if that makes you feel more soft, right, that's kind of the idea here, then please do so. So they are kind of the co-teachers on every retreat are the teddy bears. It's actually quite nice. I'm not sure how many retreat centers has as many teddy bears as we have. They seem to be accumulating in vast numbers these days, which actually is very nice. It sets a nice tone, I think, in the meditational. It reminds you of softness, right? Teddy bears, if they are anything, they are certainly soft and cuddly here. So please grab a teddy bear. Don't feel bad about that, and put it in your lap and kind of hold it, and then kind of that will remind you at least in the beginning of the meditation, right? Okay, metta, kindness, softness is good. So that's a good pointer. So anyone using teddy bears out there? I can't see anybody. But anyway, okay, let's go on to the next one. Dear Venerable, if a monk or person is hypnotized and they see past lives, is that really true knowledge? If it is, why didn't the Buddha teach it with much metta? Well, this is, I think, a good question. I think it's an important question. I think the answer is that sometimes it may be true knowledge, a lot of the time it is not. So it is very unreliable, right? It's very hard to know whether it's true or not. Of course, if you get hypnotized and you see lots of things in the past life, lots of factual things, you see the shape of things, the colors, you see names, you see people, your relationship to these people, the more facts you have on the ground, then you can actually compare it to the registries, right? Did such a person exist? Do the facts match? And of course, if there is a vast number of facts that match, then the chances for it to be just chance, they kind of go down a lot. But then again, at the same time, every now and again, there will be something like that. There will be some event which looks almost exactly like reality, simply because there are so many of these things. Occasionally there will be one which looks the right thing. So even that is not a certain bet by any means. So you're quite right. You have to be very careful. Maybe it can be, but it is probably quite rare. And I think this is why the Buddha didn't do it, because it's not really real knowledge, it's unreliable knowledge. And the only real knowledge about past lives, according to the suttas, is to get into a really deep meditation, ideally the fourth jhana, and then think backwards, right? Back to your earliest memory, and then jump into the past lives and go backwards like that. That is the really only reliable way of remembering past lives. The way you know that it is reliable is because when you see it, it is logical. It follows certain steps. You move from one life to the next one. You can see the continuation of things. And then you see the continuation all the way up to the present life. And the whole thing has a kind of logical and correct development ending in the here and now. It's not just a random sequence of pictures or a random sequence of events. It's a causally connected sequence that brings you up to the present moment. That is when you know, wow, this is the real thing here. And also, it is very real. When they, this kind of experiences, it is said by those who have them, it is as if you're there. In fact, it is more real than if you are there in the present life. It's an incredibly real thing. You re-experience these things, but in a very powerful way. Yes, anyway, so that is those are the ones that are really, really reliable. It would be interesting, of course, if somebody had a past life experience, then to also check it out, right? To see if such a person actually did exist. But sometimes the life may be so remote into the past that there is no way of checking it out. But that would certainly be interesting as well. Okay. Dear Ajahn, at one occasion, the Buddha mentioned of his ability to speak to other worlds and his understanding of other galaxies to the Venerable Ananda. Can you please describe this? Yes, he does, and it's very fascinating. I gave a talk at Amaloka about this a few months ago, about the Buddha's abilities to see other solar systems and to talk about the thousandfold solar system, the thousandfold to the second power solar system, the thousandfold to the third power. So he's talking about billions of solar systems, right? Or perhaps galaxies. It's very hard to know exactly what he's talking about because the terminology he uses, obviously, is a bit difficult to know. But it looks like he was talking about the human realm together with the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon, right? Kind of forming one unit and a thousandfold of that. So it looks like, to me, what you would call solar systems. And it is quite astonishing, right, that the Buddha should talk about these things. How can he talk about thousandfold solar systems? Now we know it is true. Only recently have we started discovering planets around other suns. And of course, the next step would be to find out whether there's life on those planets. But according to the Buddha, there is. So if we're going to follow, if we're going to have faith in those Buddhist teachings, and assuming that the Buddha actually said these things, some of these things you can't be 100% sure of because they are not talked about that much in the suttas, they're a little bit marginal. But if they were spoken by the Buddha and we assume that they are true, we can expect astronomers to find life in these solar systems in the future. That's what we should expect, because basically that's what the Buddha says in the suttas. There is all this life out there. Maybe all the Buddhas, right? So if you imagine if you want to meet the Buddha, you have to travel to this other solar system. Get yourself into a spaceship and you go off to another solar system and you meet this Buddha far away over there. That would be pretty kind of cool way to do things. But anyway, that's a kind of religious science fiction for you. A different type of science fiction. So that's one thing the Buddha talks about. Another thing he talks about is kind of the universes, right? How they expand and how they contract. And it sounds like what he's talking about is this continuous expansion and contraction of universe, like the Big Bang followed by a big crunch, if you like, and then another one. That's what it sounds like. So I would say, if you're going to place faith in the Buddha that he knew what he was talking about, then I think one day science will probably settle down on a model of the universe which is Big Bang, Big Crunch, Big Bang, Big Crunch. That would be my guess. So let's see if that actually turns out to be true. But that seems to be what the suttas are talking about. And it's astonishing. How did the Buddha know about these things? This is kind of the other question, because it is not just magic, right? These are knowledges gained through seeing things as they actually are. And the way I think that he would have seen these things is that he would have remembered his past lives. And as part of remembering the past lives, he would have seen how the universe evolves, right? How the universe kind of evolved. Maybe if you are in a higher realm, you kind of see the, almost like you're seeing the universe from above in a sense, and you can see the evolution of the universe in that way. That is what I would think. And because you've seen it in the past, you can then assume, deduce that it also will happen in the future. So I think that's quite likely to happen. It's astonishing that the suttas, in one place the Buddha talks about the sun expanding, right? Or the sun becoming hotter and hotter, and eventually burning up all life on earth. It's just astonishing. It's one of those things, you wonder how on earth could anyone 2,500 years even talk about that? It's in the suttas. It is obviously an ancient text. How is it possible? Now we know it is true. How could the Buddha have known? And of course, the answer is he would have remembered this from previous happenings and previous eons before, and then extrapolated into the future. To me, when I see this, it's like it's almost hard to believe. But actually, you know, that is what he said, right? It's there. So it's quite remarkable. And I think, I don't know why people don't talk about it. Maybe it's because they think, oh yeah, it's just a kind of interpretation or whatever. But it isn't very much interpretation at all, because it is so clear the way it is written that there's not much kind of room for doubt, really. That is a strange thing about it. Anyway, let's move on. Dear Ajahn, if so much of how we are and what we do is conditioned, then isn't our propensity to practice the Dhamma also conditioned? Yes, that's exactly correct. It is also conditioned, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, once you understand how conditioned you are, you understand, you start to place yourself in a situation whereby you are conditioned in the right way, right? In a way which kind of moves you forward on the path. That is why the Kalyanamitta, the good friend again, the Buddha, is so important, because it gives that spark of conditioning in the beginning and supports that conditioning all the way along. Yes, so everything is conditioned. If we have so little control of our actions, etc., then wherein lies our ability to rebel against conditionality? Help! Still stuck on the agency question. Thank you. Okay. Well, your ability to rebel against conditionality is itself conditioned, right? So you are conditioned to rebel against conditionality. There are certain conditionality has many different levels, many different aspects to it. So one aspect of your conditionality rebels against another aspect of your conditionality. I'm conditioned to be, you know, I have all these, I don't know what it is that you do, you know, I work very hard, I'm conditioned to work really hard, right? And then you think, wait a minute, should I really work so hard? This is just conditionality. Is this leading forward on the spiritual path or not? Is this going in the right direction? And then you can kind of rebel against that conditionality if you see that it is not supportive of your spiritual practice. This is how you do that, right? Your new conditionality, which is the Buddhist worldview, rebels against other conditionalities, and they kind of clash with each other, and they fight it out, and then one conditionality wins, another one loses out, right? The war between good and evil taking place inside of you. And so this is really how, this is in a sense how it actually, I think, truthfully does work. There are different aspects of our conditionality, and some aspects are better than others. The Buddha gives some very good advice on what life really is all about, how we should live our lives. And what he says, which I found very, very useful in my own life, is the question should always be asked, what is going to lead to an increase in good qualities inside of you and lead to a decrease in bad qualities, right? If you are living a life whereby you're always increasing the good qualities, you have more peace, more kindness, a better heart, more time for other people, more wisdom, all of these kind of things. You have less anger, greed, delusion, restlessness, and all those kind of things. Then you know that you're moving in a good direction. You know you're becoming a better person. You know you're heading towards samadhi, towards understanding, towards nibbana eventually. All of these good things are coming to you, right? And you can feel it happening right now. So it's an eminently good advice, right? So you use that as the standard for making your decisions in life. How should I live my life? And you live a life in such a way that it always increases the good qualities to the maximum and decreases the bad ones. That is how you can make all decisions in your life, what you should be doing and not be doing. But once you take that on board and you agree with that, you are allowing that idea to condition you, right? And then that idea will then counteract other conditionings which move in a different direction, and the conditionings will kind of, one will grow and the other conditioning will go down, right? So this is how it works. So there is a, you are rebelling against certain conditionings, whereas others conditionings you are accepting them, and you are allowing yourself, if you like, to be brainwashed by the other ones. So make sure you choose good conditioning. That's basically what it comes down to. So be wise, right? Wisdom is another conditioned phenomena, but if you have it, use it, and then to reflect carefully about things. Okay, so I hope that helps a little bit. In the end, you know, at the end of the, in the end, you're going to feel to some extent that you are in charge and that you are, you know, you are doing things. So in the end, you're never going to be able to see this fully. Ah, Nicholas, you have a teddy bear. Yeah, okay, very good. Okay, I certainly saw that now. That's great. Okay, so in the end, you are going to. I lost my thread of thought now, seeing this teddy bear. In the end, there's always going to be some aspect of you, you feel in charge to some extent, right? There's always going to be some degree of that. So you're never going to be able to see this 100% until you become an Aryan or a stream mentor or whatever. So don't worry too much about it. You know, use that sense of self inside of you to make good choices, to do the right thing, and then you'll be heading in the right direction. Okay. Dear Ajahn, during the last days of the Buddha, he mentioned something on keeping Dhamma as our teacher. Can you please quote this? Yes. This is from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the sutta which talks about the Buddha's last days. He talks about his travels. He walked from Rajagaha. Rajagaha was the capital of the Magadhan state at those days. The Magadhan state was the kernel from which the Ashokan Empire later emerged. And it started with the Magadhan state, gradually expanding. At the time of the Buddha, it was only a tiny country, or maybe not tiny, but a small country. And then gradually it engulfed and took in all of India, actually more than India, what is now Pakistan and Afghanistan were also included in this enormous empire. The biggest empire that India has ever seen was during the time of Ashoka. It didn't include all the way down to the south of India. There was a little tip on the south that was excluded. Sri Lanka was outside of his empire. It was like an independent kingdom at that time already. That was the kernel of that. And then the Buddha, he starts out this last voyage, walking from Rajagaha, kind of saying goodbye to the king, that sort of thing, and traveling north. And while on this long journey from Rajagaha all the way up to the place called Kusinara or Kushinagar, or it has different names depending on whether you quote it in Sanskrit or present-day Hindi or Pali or whatever. But this Kusinara is the place where he passed away. And on this long voyage, he gives a number of teachings, and they are recorded in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And as you would expect, you know, he's about to pass away. He knows that he's coming to the end of the life, of his life. As he does that, he gives teachings that are about how to preserve the Dhamma in the future, right? What the monks, what the nuns, what the lay people should do to ensure that the Dhamma lasts a long period of time into the future. And that's where he says things like, it is by practicing these things that you're doing the right thing, not by showering me with flowers and incense and this kind of stuff, right? So he kind of praises those monks who are kind of sitting in the forest meditating. There's one particular monk that is mentioned there. And then he also says something about what are the real teachings? What are the teachings that matter? What are the things that people should look to after he's passed away? Right? And what he says is that when after I passed away, he doesn't anoint a successor, somebody's kind of become the new Buddha or the new kind of master. No, he says he doesn't do that. What he does instead, he says, after I pass away, the teachings that I have given you, the vinaya, the kind of monastic rules that I have given you, this is your teacher after I have passed away. Right? So this is the teaching. Of course, that is why it is so interesting that we still have those suttas, we still have the word of the Buddha 2,500 years later, and we can access that. We can access that gift that the Buddha bequeathed to the world 2,400 years ago or whatever it is. So what a wonderful thing that is. So we use that Dhamma. Now in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha also specifies more clearly what that Dhamma means. What is the core of that Dhamma? If you read the kind of the four Nikayas, the four main Nikayas are the four main groups of discourses found in the today. It is quite large in English translation, it amounts to something like that. It's maybe about how many pages? Maybe something like 7,000 pages, perhaps, of fairly small print. So it's a lot, right? So there's a lot there. Some of that has been added later. Some of it is perhaps not quite original. But basically, that is the teaching of the Buddha. But in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he specifically says that the things that the main core of his teachings are what is known as the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. This Bodhipakkhya Dhamma means aids to awakening. Bodhipakkhya Dhamma, Bodhi is awakening. Pakkhya is what takes the side of awakening. And Dhamma is like teaching, right? The teachings that aid awakening, 37 of them. And these 37 are the Noble Eightfold Path, seven factors of awakening, the five spiritual faculties, the indriyas, the five balas, the five powers, the four focuses of mindfulness, the four idipadas. Idipadas are like what is also known as translated as the roads or the factors of spiritual power in a sense. So these are samadhi essentially, and lastly the four right efforts. And if you add all those together, you get 37. And that's why they call the 37 aids to awakening. And if you look at those things, they're all about the path, right? All about the practice, how to develop out. There's no philosophy in there, apart from very basic things like the Four Noble Truths and that sort of stuff. There's no real philosophy in that. It's all about practice. It's a very pragmatic path, the Buddhist path. It's all about how to get to the goal, the end of all suffering here. So the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is actually a wonderful sutta, very interesting in many ways, a lot of very interesting things in there, perhaps so practical, but interesting in the sense that it shows us the direction, how we should, where we find the real teachings, and many other things like that, which are interesting in there. But it's also a very long sutta, so if we did that, we would have to do a whole retreat just on the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and maybe that would be... I think it's much better to do retreats that are more practical than to do things that are too much story, perhaps, or something like that. But maybe we can bring in a few passages, because it's quite nice. Okay, dear Ajahn, could you please say again the question you asked to Ajahn Ganha about how to develop metta, and Ajahn Ganha's answer, please, with metta. Yes, it was. I just asked him how to develop metta practice. What was his way of doing that, or how he would recommend to do it, or whatever. And he said very simply, "Well, all you have to do is when you get up in the morning, you should ask yourself, what can you do for the people that cross your path today, the people you meet today, the world, the whole world today. How can you benefit the world today?" That's what you should ask yourself every morning here. And if you then do something beneficial for the world today, then that is the way to practice metta. Why? Because you are showing kindness, you're showing friendliness, you're doing something positive to help the world forward, right? In whatever way that is. So very simple, but very practical. Not too getting kind of stuck in your mind, just may all beings be happy, but actually doing it in real practice. And of course, if you do that in real practice, then when you try to do the metta in meditation, it empowers that a lot. Actually, that's true. So, dear Ajahn Brahmali, it seems obvious to me that samatha and vipassana would go together hand in hand. Yet it seems like there is such a divide in the Theravada community between vipassana and samatha. There are practitioners who say that vipassana is the only way. Why is there such a divide between the views among the Theravada community with metta? Because this is human beings. Human beings, we'd like to divide. We like to do things. This is my way. This is their way. This way is better, that way, etc. This is the way we do things, right? And we all tend to think that our way is somehow better. And it's quite natural because, otherwise, why would you do this thing, right? I mean, if I were to be honest and people would ask me, is Buddhism better than Christianity? Is Buddhism better than Islam? I would have to say, That's what I think. Otherwise, I would be foolish being a Buddhist monk, right? What's the point of being a Buddhist monk unless I thought this was the best way of doing it, of living my life? In the same way with your meditation practice. Why do you choose certain things? Well, because you think probably it is the best. It is the most efficient way of doing things. Right? So that's why these things arise, because we all think that what we are doing is the best way. And sometimes we lack that ability to see the bigger picture, to see what is truly going on. So this is how you get divisions. I think it is often very artificial. The reality is that what you should practice is the Noble Eightfold Path, right? And if what you're doing is the Noble Eightfold Path, then you are fine. Very often these things become just labels. They become words. They call this practice vipassana. We call this practice samatha, as if there is a real difference. But when you look at them, they are basically the same. They're just names used. They kind of create divisions, that there's no basis for those divisions very often. You ask people who do vipassana practice, right? They say, oh, I sit down, I watch the breath, and after watching the breath, I watch the feelings in the body. Is that vipassana or is it samatha? Well, if it works, if it reduces the defilements, it leads to two things, both vipassana and samatha. You can't really call it a vipassana practice. Any practice that works leads to both, right? So when they label that practice vipassana, it's just a name. It doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't lead to just vipassana, not samatha. That is impossible. It leads to both those qualities if it is worthy of its name. And the same thing with watching the breath, right? People say, oh, watching the breath is samatha practice. But again, watching the breath leads to both. If you read the Anapanasati Sutta, it is very explicit that from that Anapanasati, you get peaceful, and then afterwards come the insights. And for Anapanasati to work anyway, you have to work with the defilements as you go along. So insight will also happen as you go along here. So a lot of these words, these divisions, are really very artificial. And I don't think there is no such thing as samatha meditation or vipassana meditation. There is just meditation. And if it works, then it gives rise to two things. Samatha vipassana are really results. They're not techniques. They are results of what happens when you practice in the right way. The Buddha doesn't use the word vipassana as a technique. He used the word vipassana as a result of the practice. And that result is clear seeing, right? Clear seeing and calm always come together. They cannot be separated from each other. So you're right. It's been unfortunate that we have these things, right? And sometimes what happens is that the teachers themselves, the people who kind of started out with these systems, like Mahasi Sayadaw, etc., very often they were quite relaxed about things, right? And they wouldn't make such a big deal out of it. They wouldn't divide things up so much. And often it's the disciples who become more fundamentalist, right? My teacher is the best one, and this is the right way. Sometimes that's what happens. And so we have to be careful, you know, if you consider yourself an Ajahn Brahm disciple, you should be careful not to become the fundamentalist Ajahn Brahm disciple. This is the only way. Everything else is wrong. This is the path. But be careful with that, because that is not, I don't think that's what Ajahn Brahm would want himself. So I hope that helps. So let's keep an open mind and see. Look at people, see if they are developing in the right way, see if they are kind, if they have good hearts. Then they are always worthy of respect, regardless of what kind of meditation they do. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, can you please explain what is meant by kindness and compassion, metta, karuna, mudita? Thank you. Okay, so these are like the Brahma Viharas, right? Brahma Viharas, this really nice name. Brahma is kind of the god, according to the Buddhist ideas of kind of the different levels of beings. You can become this amazing being who is full of, love, kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, all of these kind of things. And these are the Brahma realms. And you can tap into those right now, right, through your meditation practice. In fact, that's how you get reborn in those realms later on, if you practice these meditations on a regular basis. So what is meant is kindness is just meant wishing other beings well, right? Seeing their good qualities, wishing them well. May you be happy and well. Seeing their good qualities, that's kindness. Wanting to help somebody else. When you see somebody and you want to give them a hand, you want to be kind to them, right? You just want to be kind. That's kindness. That's all it is. And then you bring that into your meditation and you say, may you be happy, may you be well. That is the same kind of kindness in your meditation as is the kindness outside of meditation, friendliness, supporting others, helping them out, taking the opportunity to be kind. And karuna is when you see somebody is suffering and you want to help them out of that suffering. And you kind of help them because they're suffering, not just because you want to be kind, but because you actually want to help them out of suffering. You feel, wow, you know, you all these troubles, and you want to give them a hand because of that. And mudita is like when you, traditionally explained as, if you see somebody else who has achieved something, you feel, wow, what a wonderful thing it is that you have achieved this, right? I got this really nice meditation. Whoa, what a wonderful thing. Instead of feeling jealous or kind of whatever, you feel happy on their behalf that they have actually achieved something. It's a wonderful thing to do. If you feel happy on somebody else's behalf, it's like free happiness for you, right? You get free happiness because somebody else achieves something. You feel happy for them. It's a kind of really, that is called a win-win situation, right? So mudita, very useful if you can feel happy just because somebody else is happy, just because somebody else is doing well. So get into mudita. This is really recommended. It's a very lofty kind of feeling, right? When you feel happy on somebody else's behalf, it's very beautiful. Wow, how wonderful that you had this success, right? What a wonderful thing that is. So these are the Brahma Viharas, basically. And then this last one is the Upeka, which is the highest Brahma Vihara, which is like this just looking on with equanimity. And you're completely cool, right? Nothing can really touch you in the world. This very cool person. In many, many, many ways of the word cool, you become really cool in many, many ways. So it's quite cool that we have so many cool people in the Buddhist teaching. Okay, so this is a little suggestion. If you read the sutta papers during the meditation hours in the meditation hall, could you please kindly, quietly do so? Then other meditators won't get disturbed. During the meditation hours in the meditation hall, are you asking to have suttas read out during the meditations? I'm not sure. Could you please kindly, quietly do so? Then other meditators won't get disturbed. I'm not sure if I understand what you mean, because usually we have meditation and then we have sutta readings, right? So you want me to speak more quietly during the sutta readings? Maybe nobody will get any benefit. They won't hear anything, right? If you remember what I said at the beginning, is that if you want, you don't have to come to the sutta talks, right? And if you feel during the sutta talk that you are getting peaceful and quiet, you want to meditate, then go back to your room, right? It's perfectly okay. You can leave at any time. I'm not going to write your name down in the bad book somebody leaving during my talk. You're welcome to leave at any time if you want to. You don't have to come to any of the sutta readings. I don't mind. Whatever you do is fine. Perfectly fine with me. So if you prefer to stay back in your room, please do so. You don't have to actually be here. So it's really up to you. And I can understand sometimes these sutta readings may be too theoretical, perhaps not interesting. And that is perfectly okay if you don't want to be here for that. So, okay. If I didn't understand your question, please try again and maybe later on. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, this morning you mentioned the nature of a sutta from the name of the sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, really contemplation of death. Could you please give the name of the sutta and the number again? Thank you, much better. Read the contemplation of death. There are a number of suttas that talk about that. There was the one I talked about this morning. There is another one. Somebody asked a while ago about the five contemplations, the five kind of standard contemplation, which are the three we did this morning. And also the one about being separated from what is loved and pleasing to you, and also the one about kamma, right? Being the heir of your kamma, etc. And that is found in the Anguttara Nikaya 5. Contemplation of death in the Majjhima Nikaya. I don't think there is any sutta on that in the Majjhima Nikaya. I don't think so. Is there contemplation of death in the Majjhima Nikaya? I don't think there is anything specifically on that topic. There is contemplations of death in the Anguttara Nikaya, a few of them there. I'm sure it is mentioned in the Majjhima Nikaya in kind of in passing, but I don't think there is any sutta specifically on that topic. Is that right? Am I missing something here? So I'm not entirely sure what you are asking. So maybe if you want to come up, you can ask me at any time or the time in person or whatever, and then I can maybe we can figure out what exactly that you are looking for here. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, I understand about honoring your parents and treating them with respect as part of the Buddhist path, but this is assuming that the parents are good people. What if your parents were evil? Did evil acts and encourage you to be evil and break your five precepts? What if they were disparaging to the Buddha and the Dhamma? What should one do then? If that is the case, you have to kind of say, okay, you do your things, I will do my things, right? You can't just follow your parents blindly. If your parents are silly, then you have to do things your own way. And in fact, one of the great things that you can do for your parents, again, it's according to the suttas, is that if you have parents who don't have faith, don't have virtue, you establish them in virtue, then you have really, that's the only time you can really repay your parents according to the suttas. So these are wonderful things that you can maybe do, right? You see your parents are heading in the wrong direction, doing the wrong thing or whatever. And then by living a good life yourself and doing the right thing, maybe you can inspire them. Maybe you can show them the light, right? They have seen the light finally. And then you bring them in the right direction. That's a wonderful thing to do. Because even if your parents are bad, well, the fact that you have turned out such a wonderful person, right? It's great. It means that they must have done something right. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here and doing, you know, do good things, do the right things, doing meditation retreats and whatever else. So it means they must have done something right. At least you are here. At least they have given you all those things that made it possible for you to grow up and start doing good things in life. Right? So have gratitude for that at least. You know, they did something right. They didn't do just bad things. And then if you then, through your example, through your way of living, can inspire them to do what is right, then that is even better. So, and sometimes, you know, you break with your parents and it's very difficult because of a very difficult childhood or whatever. Sometimes you can't really expect to do too much in relationship to your parents. Sometimes it's just too difficult. And then what you do instead, you try to overcome whatever hurt feelings you may have in regard to your parents just quietly inside of yourself. You learn to understand that they too are conditioned. They probably didn't want to be the way they were, right? But they, in a sense, they had no choice again. So you start understanding that. They wanted to treat you well, but somehow there was something inside of them that was stronger than that wish to treat you well. And that kind of won the day. So you forgive them. Gradually, slowly, slowly, step by step, you forgive them, right? Until one day you can let go of all the hurt and all the problems. Often it's a difficult process, but it's really worthwhile trying because it frees up so much of these kind of things from the past. It allows you to live a more full and complete life as a consequence. Okay, so that was the last question. There was one question yesterday, which I thought maybe I could bring up now. We've got a couple of minutes left. And that was somebody asking about the verses from the Sutta Nipata, from the Ratana Sutta. And they quoted verses number 10 and 14. And I looked at those two verses and I couldn't really see how the verse number 10 related to the issue of dependent origination. But I can certainly see how verse number 14 relates to it. And verse number 14 is a verse that goes about kīnaṁ puraṇaṁ navaṁ natti saṅbhavaṁ, which means that having destroyed, having made an end of the old, kīnaṁ puraṇaṁ, having made an end, having demolished, if you like, old. Old here refers to old kamma, right? So all the old kamma has come to an end in a sense. Because you become an arahant, that kamma will no longer have parition in the future. This is what we were talking about before, about consciousness does not establish itself in nama-rupa, doesn't move on into new existence. There's no kamma to support it. Consciousness isn't established in anything. Consciousness is free at that point. It's unsupported. That was somebody else mentioned also in another note a few days ago, which I didn't answer fully because I forgot, but it's talking about the unsupported consciousness, right? And that consciousness which is unsupported is what I understand the consciousness of the arahant between the moment they become arahants and they die. That is unsupported consciousness. It's not standing on anything. There's a simile in that sutta. It was actually part of the suttas I gave out. I didn't do that sutta because it was getting a bit too much. But it has a simile of the rays of the sun entering the window of the house. And when they go through the window, they hit the wall on the other side of the house. And the Buddha said, what if the wall isn't there? Right? What if there is no like sensual realm? There's no wall there. He asked the monks, where does the sun go? Where do the rays of the sun hit? And they hit the ground. What if there is no ground? Well, then they hit the water, right? Assuming that there is an ocean further away. What if there is no ocean? Well, the rays don't get established anywhere. Just like the consciousness isn't established anywhere. So I understand that as to mean the consciousness of the arahant isn't established in anything. It is not directed towards anything. It is not interested in anything anymore. It is free of all that. And that is the unestablished consciousness of the arahant. That is my understanding of that. And that is kinang puranang. The old has been destroyed. The old karma has been destroyed. Navang natti sang bhavang. There is no origination of new karma. Navang is new. New karma is what it means there. Viratta citta yatike bhavasming, which means viratta citta is the mind which doesn't have any desire anymore. Doesn't have any viratta is means like passion, right? Craving, interest, desire. The citta is the mind without desire. Ayatike bhavasming, future existence, quite literally. The mind that has no desire for future existence. Kina bija avirulhi chanda. Kina bija. One of the monks is called Kina bija. You know that? He's taken it from the Ratana Sutta. We call him KB for short, just to make it easy. It actually is Kina bija. Kina bija means the seed, the one who has destroyed the seed, quite literally. And the seed here is the seed of consciousness in the future life. There is one of the suttas I was reading out, it says the kamma is the field, consciousness is the seed, right? That seed consciousness, which will grow again in the future life, has been ended, made an end of, or destroyed, if you like. Kina bija, avirulha chanda. Avirulha means to grow, right? Chanda is desire, so the desire for growth has come to an end. The A in front, a virulha chanda, the desire for growth has come to an end. No more desire for growth in that future state. Chanda, nibanti dira yatayang padipo. Nibanti, extinguished, as it relates to the word nibbana, which means extinguished. Nibanti dira, dira is like the wise person, right? The sage. Nibanti dira yatayang padipo. Padipo is lamp. Yatayang, as, like a lamp. So the sage is extinguished like a lamp. This is one of those metaphors in the suttas for the arahant. The arahant, especially upon parinibbana when they die, they are extinguished like a lamp going out. In the same way, you are extinguished at parinibbana, the going out of the flame. So that is you're very right indeed, that is very much related to that dependent arising thing and how kind of when you become an arahant, the whole thing comes to an end. Very profound verse and very, you know, it's not easy to understand these things. But anyway, that's the meaning of some of those verses. Very, very beautiful, you know, if you kind of fully grasp what's going on, I suppose. So that's really... the Ratana Sutta, if you want to look it up, found in the Sutta Nipata in the Kudaka Nikaya. So there you are. Okay, so that is all for this evening. So let's do the Arahant Sammasambuddha before we call it a night. I'll see you tomorrow morning. Yeah.